Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A nationwide survey conducted by UC Davis gauged the views and willingness to engage in political violence. Researchers said the findings exceeded their worst expectations. The survey, which is yet to be peer-reviewed, also reveals an escalating level of mistrust in American democracy. But within this grim landscape is the groundwork for hope. To get a better understanding of what this research means, I spoke with Dr. Garen Wintemute, director of the California Firearm Violence Research Center and Violence Prevention Program at UC Davis. Garen, you know, I have interviewed you several times over the past 5 years or so. You're a former emergency room physician in Sacramento that led you to study violence and gun violence research. When I read your headline or the headline for your latest survey, I wasn't surprised by the headline. However, despite that, reading the specific findings was incredibly surprising.
Yes. Sort of parallel train of thought. I had done some preliminary research last year and came away realizing that lots of important questions had not been answered. So we deliberately repeated questions that had been asked before to set the foundation for new material. So some of what you read, you have basically read before, although it's been refreshed. But the information on the specifics of engaging in political violence under particular circumstances, willingness to do it personally, details about targets and lethality, that's all new.
Yeah, there were some that I literally, while reading it, I had to say it out loud because they were particularly more striking. I mean, one was preferring a strong leader versus a democracy. You have 42% or so agreeing that having a strong leader for America is more important than having a democracy. What led to the language for that survey question?
Yeah, I drafted that language, I can tell you. I had been looking, our group had been looking at the questions that had been asked before and decided we, here and in other places, we needed to push it. We needed to ask people to make a concrete choice. And the statement, people are asked to agree with that statement, which in essence asks them to choose between a strong leader or a democracy. I wrote those words sitting right where I'm sitting right now, and I remember a real sense of foreboding, just putting the words into the computer that we might find something pretty grim, and we did. The 40% includes lots of people who say they somewhat agree, and those people could be hedging their bets. But 20% strongly or very strongly agree with that statement. We asked them to make a choice between strong leader and democracy, and they went for strong leader. That's not good news.
Half of over the more than 8,000 people that you surveyed across the country, I mean, literally like roughly half, believe that there will be a civil war within the next several years. Does this go along the same gradient of somewhat to actually strongly believing this?
Yeah, it does. The 50% includes what I've started to call the somewhaters. The people who strongly or very strongly agree amount to less than 20% of the population. But let's say it's one in six adults strongly or very strongly agrees that there will be civil war in the United States in the next few years. That's millions and millions of people. And as we launched this work, you know this, Vicky, I know a lot about gun violence, but political violence was new for us. So I looked at the work of experts, one of whom is in the Washington Post recently, saying these people are preparing for war. We need to acknowledge the reality of the threat and do something about it.
That was going to be my next point, because if you have, you know, half, even somewhat believing that this could take place in the near future, that leads people, when they're thinking about it, to prepare.
That's correct. And actually, one of the criticisms of doing the survey and publicizing the results is by merely bringing the idea to the public's awareness, we may foster other people to prepare. And we talked about that a lot internally. Our decision was, there is a problem. We need to talk about the problem. That's much more important because too many people are simply not paying attention. And what we need to do, those of us who don't want civil war, who renounce violence, is recognize that a fair portion of the population does want and is preparing for those things so that we can counter the threat and not wait for it to appear on our doorstep.
Well, peel back the curtain a little bit more. What conversations took place on the front end to reduce harm while notifying and alerting the public?
We made a deliberate decision to report the findings for those somewhat people, even though they lead to larger percentages. But that has led to, as in this conversation, lots of qualifying about the sort of core level of support. We've made very substantial efforts to get this information to policymakers, to thought leaders. I have an opinion piece out today that talks specifically about the sorts of things such people who can do to reduce the threat. But let me give you an analogy that everybody will be familiar with, COVID. So in late 2019, early 2020, COVID wasn't here yet, but it was really important to talk about it so that we could prepare because it might come, and then in fact it did. We're in that same situation here. We can't ignore the threat as it grows. We have got to talk about it. We have got to organize and respond to it.
Right. And that leads me to another finding in your survey. Roughly a fifth, 20.5%, think that political violence is at least sometimes justifiable in general. However, your research also found a large majority of those who endorse political violence say they're actually unwilling to participate in violence themselves. What comes to the front of my mind is this distinction or potentially lack thereof between participation and enabling.
Yep. I think this is really important and one of several places in this sort of grim landscape of data where we find room for hope. So let me flip it around. 80% of the population says that in general, political violence is never justified. Now, I'm going to take that away a little bit because after we asked the in general question, we asked everybody, well, what about these specific situations? Would it be, we asked 15 of those. And 80% of the population said yes to at least one of those 15 specific circumstances. But most of them said yes to only one. And so we end up thinking that it may well be that support for political violence is basically a mile wide and an inch deep, that most people say never under any circumstances. For those who do, whether in general or in some specific situation, the vast majority say, but I wouldn't want to do it myself. And so I think our task is for those majorities, the ones who say never, ever, and the ones who say maybe, but not me, to recognize there is this small subset who say, yes, it's justified, and I will do it. We haven't yet talked about the people who say, and I'll kill somebody, but I assume you're getting there. But recognize that there is a real threat on the horizon, and do something now. Federal elections are 4 months away. And as I've talked about for a year and a half now, it's a rhetorical question, but I think it capsulizes this pretty clearly. What do we think is going to happen when armed voter suppression, and don't tell me we don't think that's coming, meets armed voter support? We have a chance to intervene before those conflicts arise.
Right. Well, let's get to some of the survey respondents who said that it would be justifiable in some cases to actually kill someone. And that is a fraction of the 20.5% that we're talking about of individuals who think political violence, or those surveyed who believe that political violence is at least sometimes justifiable. So that's less than, 10% of that 20.5. Or no, you're shaking your head. It doesn't work like that.
I'm shaking my head. Yes. So We asked those questions not of the people who said yes in general. We asked those questions of the 80% of people who said yes to at least one of the specifics. So the percentages are of the 80% who said yes. And then in the publication, we extrapolate it to a percentage of the whole population and numbers of people. But we end up with a fair percentage of the population. It is less than 10%, but of the whole population, not of the subset, it's about 7%, who say there's at least some circumstance under which I personally would be willing to kill somebody to advance a political objective. Now, let's say that it's 5%. That's 12.5 million people in the United States who are willing to say to a surveyor, I will kill somebody to advance a political objective. I'm suspecting that most of those people wouldn't actually do it, but still, a huge armed force at the national level is 2.5 million people, globally speaking. And here we have 12.5 million people who say, I'm willing to kill somebody for a political objective. And we asked the question sort of twice because it was so important. So separately, we asked everybody whether they owned a gun or not, whether they espoused political violence in the present or not. In the future, might you be in a situation where you think political violence is justified and with a gun, and what would you do? And about 4% of the group said, I would shoot somebody.
What does that tell us about the collective mentality where we're at in society? Because I think a part of that is also fear, right?
Yep. So at several levels. First off, people buy guns more out of fear than for all reasons put together, which is why we're still in the middle of an unprecedented surge in gun purchasing, because people have lots of things to be afraid of. But it's also clear, and I'm relying on the conclusions of experts on political violence, of which I am not one, who say that much political violence stems from fear or willingness to commit it. Probably the lead example is fear of replacement, the replacement delusion, that there's a conspiracy to replace native-born white Americans with immigrants and people of color, to use the phrasing. Those aren't my words, but that's how it's stated. If I'm afraid of being replaced, I might want to use violence to keep that from happening. So all of that at this moment is inference, but we have those data. We simply haven't done the analysis yet. So in a few weeks, I'll probably be able to talk in much more detail about the motivations behind what we're talking about today.
That survey question that you brought up, that came out to about 41.2% of respondents that agreed that, quote, in America, native-born white people are being replaced by immigrants. What did your survey discover, if any, regarding the role race plays in people's attitude towards political violence?
So we haven't yet done that analysis beyond some individual questions. So I can't talk in detail. But beyond that one, we did find that a surprisingly high percentage, about, again, if I remember correctly, about 40%, said, gave at least somewhat level of agreement to the statement that, I'm paraphrasing, white people face as much discrimination as people of color do. That was higher than I expected to see. We're going to want to look in more detail, look at several questions in combination, look at the demographics. I don't think it's a revelation to anyone to say that racism is alive and well in the United States. I think what we'll be able to report on in more detail is the likelihood, I think, at this point, that racism is motivating some of the political violence that we're reading about. Let me amplify just a bit. So our statement about replacement theory got a 40% support level. While our survey was in the field, the Associated Press came out with a poll that asked it somewhat differently. They said there is a conspiracy to replace, et cetera. So they made it intentional and invoked conspiracy thinking. And they got a 30% endorsement rate with a conspiracy explicitly stated. So let me get really grim with you here. I have not put this in the paper. If I believe in the replacement delusion, if I think I'm being replaced, conspiracy or otherwise, and I don't think that's a good idea, then violence, if I look at the demographics of interpersonal violence, which involve young men of color predominantly, again, this is me speculating, it's much worse than I, Garen, the researcher, have been saying for decades. It's not that I distance myself from that problem because it involves people who are not like me. If I think I'm at risk of being replaced, violence isn't even a problem. It's the solution to a problem. It's eliminating my replacements. Now, we did not ask that question. That is speculation, but it's consistent with the evidence. And it has had me thinking that violence prevention work may face a much steeper hill than we thought, that we may be needing to address the fact that there are many people in the United States who think the violence is on balance, a good thing. It's eliminating their replacements.
This survey was made public before a peer review, however. Why release it ahead of it being evaluated from the medical community and your peers?
So this is not our standard practice. It is an accepted practice when the findings are very urgent and time sensitive. For the last 2.5 years, as an ER doc, I've been relying on material that hasn't been peer reviewed yet, as has the entire medical community, because peer review takes weeks to months and people were dying. There just wasn't enough time. In this case, we've got federal elections 4 months from now, and peer review could take half that time. And we made a deliberate decision, and we're very open about it, to release early. What we did do was send the paper, even before it went up online, to experts in the field and said, take a look at this. Can we send media and people to you for your assessment of the work? So it's peer review without the formal peer review structure. And they've been commenting and they've pointed out, well, gee, we don't know enough. We don't know about partisanship and so on. And that's just coming. But no one has found fault with the methodology.
What's also interesting is the timeliness of your survey, because it was conducted between May 13th and June 22nd, when the House's January 6th committee held its first 4 public hearings. What impact do you believe the hearings might have had on the attitudes of your participants in the survey?
Yeah, I've been shaking my head. I mean, we made the decision to do this survey in December of last year. It takes about 6 months to get a survey rolling, and that's what it took. When the survey was in the field, the Buffalo mass shooting happened, and suddenly the replacement delusion was in the news while people were seeing the survey. More broadly, it's possible that the hearings affected people's responses with regard to some of the questions on democracy. The other is there was the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and maybe more importantly for American respondents, our response to that invasion, which may have affected people's answers about using force to defend democracy, because that's, I think, the U.S. understanding of what's happening in Ukraine. But you can't predict those things. You just have to acknowledge that if the survey were done 2 weeks earlier or later, the results might be a little different.
And we're talking about political violence, and you also specifically study and research gun violence, which, you know, sometimes they can be combined, but they also can be different. In what ways does this survey show how gun violence and political violence is intertwined, and what doesn't it show?
So far what we've done is report just very preliminary questions about the possibility that people would use guns in political violence. In the trove of data we're analyzing, we have very detailed information on firearm ownership, not just yes, no at a personal level, but how many guns and of what kind, and have you bought any recently? Do you own assault type weapons, et cetera? And we will be looking at those data in relationship to questions about willingness to be involved in political violence. One of the things that's been clear just from the, as all of us do, monitoring the rhetoric, is a lot of the rhetoric that's sort of saber rattling that suggests that political violence is a way to solve the nation's problems makes explicit reference to firearms as a way to carry that violence out. That's what drove my concern a year and a half ago, that we were seeing a convergence between support for political violence and rising levels of crime and rising unprecedentedly high rates of firearm purchase. And the question a year and a half ago was, what happens if these trends converge? And that's what motivated the survey to begin with.
There are more firearms than people in the United States, correct?
Correct. 400 million, give or take.
You were quoted in the LA Times a day or two ago saying that we are right now in the middle of a huge national experiment, given everything that we just laid out. Are we too far behind on the curve to get ahead of this?
No. I am a hopeful and optimistic person by nature, but in this case, I think I've got evidence in my pocket. We've talked about some of it, that most people renounce political violence just right across the board. And most of those who are entertaining the thought don't want to do it themselves. I think that's grounds for moving forward. But the darker side of it is this. We are in the middle, rates of fatal violence are higher than they've been in a generation. And we're in an absolutely unprecedented surge in gun purchasing, which is continuing. We have data through June, and it's still continuing.
So last month.
Oh, yeah. The data for a given month are available basically the first working day of the next month. We see spikes like when there's a mass shooting or something, but this started in January of 2020. And now, 2.5 years later, it's still going on. So the sort of alarmist approach to this is this rhetorical question. What happens when you take a society that is very angry at itself, and nobody sees that anger diminishing, and you make guns much more readily available to that society than they were? We have no choice but to live through the experience that will answer that question.
You said the word alarmist, and I think a lot of people that are going to be listening to this, or even just myself reading your survey and taking in the findings, it's hard not to leave and not feel alarmist, yet go on with your life. How do you do that? How do you achieve that on a daily basis?
I've had a lot of practice. I've been doing it for 40 years. I do this. I'm an ER doc. Being passive is simply not an option. I am confronted, and I would argue the nation is confronted, with a huge and complicated problem. I have no option but to do the best I can to address that problem. And that's what I'm posing here. Yes, these results are shocking. There were some very dark conversations among the research team as we started looking at the results. But I argue we don't have the option to stop there. Step one is to get the information done. Step two is to recognize its implications and to be alarmed. Great, fire bell in the night. But step three is we all need to become firefighters. We all need to figure out at an individual level at a societal level how to address this problem, how to address the circumstances that lead to it. The sense of disenfranchisement, of being left behind, of not having an opportunity to participate in this society, which pertains to a lot of this society at the moment. So there are some things we can do quickly, ideally. Tune down the rhetoric. Start talking about violence as a good idea. Thought leaders need to do that because they will get what they ask for. But more broadly, we need, and this is something that other people say with much more knowledge than I have, we need a society that doesn't leave people feeling left out, that gives them a real sense that there are ways other than violence to be heard.
Dr. Wintemute, on that note, thank you so much for the time.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that was my conversation with Dr. Garen Wintemute, director of the California Firearm Violence Research Center and Violence Prevention Program at UC Davis, discussing their nationwide survey gauging Americans' views and willingness to engage in political violence. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.